This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irarangi tamoto, MPR. If you're a fan of MPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Ian McKelvey,
Jane Bolton, Alison Alden,
and I'm Stuart Burks. So given your involvement in local industry, agriculture, politics and so on, how do you see things developing now? For instance, climate change, is that something that's given a lot of attention?
Climate change and the environment. I always link climate change and the environment, but I'm told I'm not allowed to, and I think there's probably some sense in that because I think they are different. I think that in New Zealand we've got some massive advantages and some disadvantages when it comes to climate change. Clearly, with respect to climate change, our methane emissions are a problem because we're such a heavily agricultural and animal-based reliant country. With our electricity, for example, we're probably one of the more sustainable electricity systems in the world. We've still got 15 or 20% we can pick up, of course, in that area. So we've got two challenges that we've really got in this area are the tyranny of distance, because everywhere you go in New Zealand, you've got to drive a car, basically. Public transport's abysmal, and that applies to our older communities as well. So it's abysmal for the reason that you can't have one person get on the bus from here to Fielding each day because it just won't work. And so our rural towns and communities, which are becoming much more popular as people move out of cities because of the communication advantages we've got, you can work from anywhere in New Zealand basically now, and people are. And so Compulton, for example, is a very popular little town to live in because people go up there, and there's quite a lot of people who are nationally renowned authors that live in Compulton, who can live there and do their work. And
okay. Can you name one or two?
Dennis Fryer lived there for a long time, and he was one of the more, prominent garden gurus around the country. So he's one of them that lives there. The poet also lives in Compulton. Massey Mann.
Tom Scott.
Dennis Gavigan. He's an absolute classic. Gavigan. He comments a lot on law issues on the radio.
No, I don't know.
I can't think of his name either now. But he's a classic. He lives there, and he's probably one of the most well-known poets in New Zealand. Also, a professor at Massey. And so it's a place that sort of thing happens in. And I think it's the environment. It's such a nice environment to live in. But that's becoming more prominent around New Zealand. Yeah. And yet we've got this big issue with transport. So we're always going to have cars. And we've also got to have the electricity going into those little communities that will then be able to charge everyone's car at night time. And whilst it might be a bad thing if they're charging at night time, won't be too good if they're trying to charge between 5 and 7 at night.
Well, one argument might be if it's far more expensive to service those smaller communities, like they're talking about, you know, phones and power to farms and internet access to farms and so on. Should we really be developing those? Or is it feasible?
Yes, I think it's absolutely feasible. And I think if you look at the fact that they've now put another satellite above it. So Farmside uses a satellite in New Zealand, which unfortunately isn't high enough to get coverage right around New Zealand, so there's some places where it's shut out. There's a new satellite being put up by, I can't remember his name, one of those well-known international people, is putting a new satellite up in here which will give us full coverage around New Zealand, which will be amazing. So whilst it's a little more expensive, like everything, the more people that use things, the cheaper it gets, I guess, but I think that's a huge advantage we've got, and the other great advantage we've got in New Zealand, which was certainly a disadvantage to us for the first 150 years of our kind of exporting trade, was the fact we're so isolated. It's a great advantage now to be isolated in this funny world we live in. And so, it's also a massive advantage when it comes to food production, because all those diseases and challenges that growers and food manufacturers based around the rest of the world is easily eliminated in New Zealand. So we've got some big advantages when it comes to providing safe food as well, provided we manage ourselves properly.
Now, one aspect with climate change, recently they've actually started talking about adaptation rather than try to limit emissions. But for farming, farming's adapted a great deal even since the reforms of the 1980s. But are they looking forward as well?
I find it really quite an interesting discussion, this, because I have it with my political friends. My generation of farmers are intimidated by what's going on. But my children's generation of farmers not frightened at all of what's going on. So I think we'll see quick adaption to some of the stuff, and it'll happen because the people farming the farms, not the people owning the farms. And so I'm pretty optimistic about the future wherever we go with some of these challenges, because I think that our next generation of farmer will adapt to these things.
Is that because they can adapt very quickly, or we know what to adapt to? Are they doing things at the moment?
No, yes, they are doing things at the moment, and I think they're doing them quite quickly. I also think that that it's a little bit like the technology, you know. My grandchildren have shown me how to work the TV, no trouble at all, but I can't show them how to work it. And that's what's happening with our lives.
But they're educating. They've grown up with it, so it's easy for them.
So in the Manawatū, how do, I suppose, these younger farmers think things will change? There'll be higher temperatures and more rainfall. Are they planning for that, or are they seeing something else?
I think they're hoping for that.
Yeah.
Because in the Hawke's Bay, they're not.
Yeah.
I think it's much more a matter of adapting to environmental challenges, which will then lead to a natural compliance with whatever climate change regime comes in. So some of the environmental challenges we face are leading to different ways of farming, to different methods, obviously, but also to having a much more diverse landscape around the farm. So rather than having it in Canterbury, it's the worst example of it, unfortunately, they've flattened every tree in Canterbury and shoved pivot irrigators across the place and shoved black and white cows everywhere. I think the reversing out of that is going to be challenging in places like Canterbury and Southland, because the very high debt levels that have gone into servicing those places. The Manawatū doesn't face the same challenge as that, because we're a much more conservative area, the Manawatū, than lots of parts of New Zealand. And so I think you'll see our farmers adapt to that sort of thing very quickly. And so it will lead to a lesser number of cows, probably no lesser production. And if you look at the sheep industry, that's been hugely successful in achieving that. With half the number of years, we breed the same amount of meat. I mean, so it's quite achievable. And I think that the environmental benefits of having a diverse land use, for example, I mean, we have horses and motorbikes at our place, so you can combine a horse and a motorbike, and it works from a recreational perspective. There's a whole lot of recreational benefits and all this sort of stuff. And I think it's, in some ways, I think it's quite exciting. It has to be fundable, of course, and that's one of the challenges the government faces, is that as they get this change implemented, they're going to have to make sure that it's fundable, because if it's not, then farmers will get adversely to it and won't do it. And so it's got to be able to be achieved sustainably. So that's one of the big challenges we've got.
Do you think we've moved away from agriculture being the dominant area in New Zealand? There's more city dwellers who don't understand these things?
Oh, I think that's completely true. Unfortunately, because still 70% of our cash receipts come from agriculture. And so we wouldn't exist as a country too well without our agricultural base. And I don't think you can. I don't think there's anyone to blame for that. It's just something that's happened, as we've progressed, like the rest of the world has, to urbanise itself. And I don't necessarily like the urbanised trend. And I think that Auckland's suffering as a result of that right now, because they've become so popular. But then you go to places like Marlton, Tamaroa, and Fielding, and probably Ashurst, and find a whole lot of people shifting out of Auckland and relocating themselves to those towns.
Absolutely.
And it's quite an advantage, I think, to have those people. They bring more money to the town, they bring new energy to the place, and whilst they're always, almost always of an older variety of people, they do regenerate a place, and their kids all turn up, and it's interesting. And I think the same thing is happening in agriculture, really. We've just got to make agriculture ensure that it becomes sustainable, and it's an industry that people want to be attracted to. And it's very interesting when you look at the labour challenges that agriculture seems to have around particularly around horticulture and the wine industry at the moment. The apple industry is saying their apples are all going to fall on the ground. Well, perhaps they should have thought of that a long time ago, and it's easy to be critical of people, but actually we've got to do things in New Zealand that are sustainable within a New Zealand Inc. way. And,
yeah.
And whilst I think the RSE schemes bringing people in from the Pacific is a great idea, because it actually sends
the
a
RSE
winter,
scheme is the
which is that it allows the people to come in from the Pacific to work and then go home again. So it's effectively a scheme that they come in here for 6 to 9 months,
yeah.
work here, and then go home and then come back again.
Yeah.
So it's an annual visa, effectively a work visa, which allows them to come in. And it's a great advantage to the Pacific Islands, because it's enabling them to send money home and gives them more cash.
Well, that causes a difficult issue then. Do we want to be self-sufficient and have young people going and fruit picking, or do we think, well, this is actually an important contribution we can make to the viability of the Pacific Islands community?
Well, I think there's a balance there, because almost all the Pacific Islanders that I know in New Zealand have relations who come and go from New Zealand as well. And so that's a sort of almost a large family. And you know, in Martin we've got a very large Samoan community, which is interesting, because they've come into work in the meat works there. And so there's a lot of Samoan families live in Martin. I think the population's over 500 in a town of sort of 4,500, so it's quite significant.
Yeah.
And they've come in simply to work in the freezing works.
Yeah.
And they add to the community, and then they go. Some of the members of the family go home. Some of them stay here. So I think we do have an obligation to Pacific Islands to assist in that way. But at the same time, I think if you look at the kiwi fruit industry, they've quickly worked out they don't have a workforce, they haven't got an industry, and so they've gone out of their way to create a much more integrated workforce. So they've got work for, even if it's only 9 months a year, at least it's 9 months a year, not three. And I think that you can't expect people to shift around like we did when I was young. People moved around New Zealand and went fruit picking in Nelson, and that was a great life, actually.
Yeah.
Now it's the older people that do that, and you see them packed up down at Tendertips, for example. There's a whole lot of camper vans parked out the back, and they're all
packed. Where is that?
So Tendertips is the asparagus place.
Tendertips.
Lewis Farms, they call themselves,
yeah,
and they sell ice creams and all sorts of stuff, but they've also gone to raspberries and strawberries. And interestingly, that one of the challenges that the strawberry industry has is you have to bend down all the time to pick strawberries. Well, all of Lewis Farms strawberries are grown at eye level, basically. So you walk along the road and they're all grown and they're hydroponic, basically. And so that's what I was talking about earlier when I talked about the new methods of growing food. I mean, it's just so different than it used to be, and it's no longer an onerous task. It's a nice job.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's a lot of ways we can change what we do.
Yeah.
The dairy industry is the one that really struggles with changing its systems, because at the end of the day the cows are going to be milked at 5 o'clock in the morning.
You've got robot milking and structures, and even the new idea, instead of fencing your farms, you have the phone, the tag around the animal, and the farmer with his phone, and he draws a line on some of their experimenting with
anyway. So I've been to one of those farms. It's fascinating. It's effectively factory farming, in my view, and I think there'll be challenges with that. But
you mean the robotic milking?
Robotic milking is a little bit different issue, but having no fences, it's effectively
factory
farming, because you're controlling them.
You're
remotely controlling the animal's movement. I don't know whether that'll all together be sustainable in the long term, but it might be. I could be completely wrong.
Okay.
But robotic milking, I think the systems and the infrastructure on current dairy farms doesn't allow for it to happen easily. And so it's going to take a while to introduce, but I do think it's quite exciting and got great potential.
Okay. Now, also, you mentioned about the Pacific Islanders in Martin and elsewhere. There's been a change, as I understand it, someone coming from overseas. A change in that at one time they think, we're New Zealanders, the UK is home, and so on, and now we see ourselves as far more a Pacific country because of the links to the islands and so on. Is that something that you've observed?
Well, I think we've probably moved even further than that now. I think we've probably moved into Asia. And so if you look at the, for example, the Chinese population in New Zealand, that's only a small piece of the Asian population in New Zealand. It's a very large part of our population now. And so our population base has diversified dramatically since the 1980s when effectively we felt Britain kicked us out of the out of the European market, and so we've come a long way in that time, and I think it's exciting. I think that I'm not one of those New Zealanders who think we should be along the Winston Peters mould, who think we should be shutting up our borders and not letting anyone in. I think that as long as we control, and we've proved we haven't recently, as long as we control our growth to an extent that we can then cater for it, then I think that's a space for us to be in. And, you know, when you think the world population is increasing at the rate it is, then we've got a role to play in that as a country, and we need to make sure we do.
So, I mean, some people would say we really don't want a large population in New Zealand. You think if we're ready, if we can accommodate it, that's good?
I think that we need to grow at a moderate rate. It's a very interesting political debate, because there are some of our political friends who would have this country grow, open its borders, basically. In a funny way, I think 9/11 taught the world a great lesson on everyone going everywhere whenever they want. And I think COVID's done it again. Yeah. So I think that we're getting constant reminders that actually we should be a little bit careful about how we, you know, progress some of these issues, because the world's a big place and it's challenging.
Okay. Now then, as a politician, well, two things, from agriculture and politics. From agriculture, you know about the problems of imported pests and diseases and reactions and so on, but also you've been in Parliament through this whole past year of COVID, and how do we respond? And I suspect that the New Zealand agricultural experience helped with people's willingness to comply with the restrictions that were put in place. But more, as you observing it from the inside politically, would you have anything to say on New Zealand response? Was it well planned? Were we ready for it?
I don't think we were ready for it at all. But I do think that the government has done as good a job as could have probably been done in the circumstances. So I've got no criticism of that. I think the last week or so, though, has proved a few points to us that we've probably neglected to concentrate on. One is, I think that the world's a small place with a lot of people in it, and I think it's inevitable this has become a more frequent occurrence in the future. And I think that if we want to be connected to the rest of the world, we want people coming and going, we're going to have to build facilities that enable people to come and go, enable those people that work in them to be much safer than they have been with the current environment of using hotels dotted around the city.
So to put that in context, the current experience, we've had an outbreak, but there's been certain communities where some people who were supposed to isolate were mixing with others, and then it was actually spreading. So there's a question, should we go with the soft compliance, try and bring people willingly along, or should people be penalised? Is there a debate on that?
Oh, very much so, and I think the key to the debate, in my view, is the fact that the 4,999,000 New Zealanders that have complied have gone through an awful lot of pain to get us to where we've got to, and you get one or two recalcitrant type people that, in my view, need to be locked up, basically, and probably should be. And I think that's the argument we should have. We shouldn't have an argument that we're doing well compared to the rest of the world, because we couldn't do well, no one could do well.
Yeah.
I mean, as I said to someone yesterday, we're 3 hours from landing on a seal here. In Britain, which is half an hour from everywhere in the world, basically, and with a massively complicated border and all sorts of things, which just, you can't compare us with anyone else, not even Australia, because the Northern Australian border is also fragile. So we've got every advantage, and we should have been good at it. And so it's no good making excuses that we're better off than everyone else. We certainly are better off than everyone else, but we should have been. And we're paying for it, actually, at $600 million a week.
Yeah.
We're going to be.
Yeah. we're locked down, Well, the government's line is if you penalise people, then they'll be less willing to come forward and help you trace these sorts of things.
Well, that's some sort of a theory, but I think at the end of the day, I think the real challenge that the government's got, and I'm not quite sure of my ground on some of this, but because I've asked for some stats on it today, but I think the problem we've got in New Zealand is that a lot of the people that are working in these facilities have got probably one or two or three jobs that they're working in every week.
Because these are low incomes, possibly from the islands and
exactly,
so on, and language issues and education.
And they're challenged to live anyway. And so
Auckland's them, very hard with the living.
It is, and you expect them then to knock off for a week while they isolate. They can't afford to knock off for a week while they isolate. So we need to have a very quick and reactive system of making sure they've got enough money to live on. that will encourage people, in my view, to isolate and do what they should do. I think when they're under pressure to live and under pressure from their family probably to go to work, they're going to do that.
So it's assistance rather than enforcement. Again, the software.
Well, no, I think we need to be strong on the fact that we don't break the law, but I think we also need to be very quick to react to assist those people that are, that actually are keeping the rest of us safe, really, when you think about it.
Yes.
We need to do that quickly, and I'm not sure we are doing that as well as we could, but there's a lot of learnings out of this, and one of the key learnings and the most exciting thing I think that's come out of it is the fact that agriculture is actually respected New Zealand for a short time. It might last long, but the country and the government realised that if it hadn't been for our food production sector, we wouldn't have had a great time in the last 12 months. So it's positive.
Yes.
So what, with your time in Parliament then, what sort of stands out to you as the...
Well, I think the two things that stand out are the previous Prime Minister and John Key, and the current Prime Minister, both had this kind of appeal about them that had nothing to do with party politics, basically. They could have ridden over anything. And I guess in a funny way that's a concern, because if you look at the world of Donald Trump, that was his idea of the world as well. And I think that... I think that the team behind those prime ministers is the key to it, and John Key certainly had a strong team behind him, and I just hope this prime minister's team, certainly the finance minister, seems to be handling the job very well. I hope that they've got enough strength behind them, because I don't think personality politics is really the answer to the future of the world.
Is that a matter of the media and the nature of voters and how much they want to look into the issues rather than just a gut feeling?
Well, I'm sort of loath to criticise the media because they're under-resourced. And so what's happened is we've drifted into this modern world with all this new, where everything lasts for a minute and we can get information at the drop of a hat and we can find it out. The media's been, the historic media's been undermined, and we've now got what I call an opinion-based media, and it's usually the media person's opinion themselves, no one else's. Mm-hmm. And you can't really blame them for that, because that's where they've been put, but there are very few good investigative journalists left in New Zealand, and I notice the government's now looking to fund the media to some extent. Now, hopefully that won't be just with propaganda for the government, hopefully they'll actually fund the ability of people to go out and investigate properly and look at stuff. And as we talked about earlier with the councils, there's no reporting of what councils do. Councils report themselves, so there's no effective reporting of what governments do now. The government reports it themselves as well.
This was the general issue with the media as a whole. People are trained as journalists. They work for 1 or 2 years to learn the ropes, just processing PR reports that have come out of business or government or whatever, and then they get employed as PR people writing the reports.
Yeah, for a while, until the next politician takes over, because if you look at the number of opinion pieces written in a lot of our media now, it's done by ex-politicians. I mean, extraordinary.
Yes,
and so they're going to have a bias all of their own, aren't they? And so it's very unsatisfactory.
Yeah. Do you think Helen Clark's actually very influential now with Jacinda Ardern as Prime Minister?
Well, I think she was in the early days very influential. I'm not so sure she is now. I was very pleased to see that Eden Park's allowed to run a concert again now, despite the fact that Helen had put up opposition to it, having lived there for about 20 years of Eden Park's 100 and whatever years of life. I see that they've overturned her appeal, and they can actually listen to a concert at Eden Park, which is what it was built for. Well, one of the things it was built for. I think that she is, and I think that ex-politicians... I think I've always had a very strong principle in life, and I've undone myself once. I think when you leave something, you go, and you get out of the way, and you let the next people take over. And I interfered in a rating issue in the Mental Tube District. I didn't interfere, I made a comment about it, which actually I won, because the people turned it over. But I think that you should get out of the way and leave it to the next generation. I think the next generation are very capable of doing stuff, and the moment you finish, you should go. And Bill English, you might know, Bill English has had nothing to do with politics since he left. He's not said a word. He's turned up in Parliament about twice that I've seen to listen to one of his ex-staffers either make a speech or do something. And John Key, I wouldn't guarantee he'll stay out of politics. But we've seen too many interferers. Jim Bulge is a classic example. Michael Cullen's had a crack at it. I just think that they've done their job, and they did a great job. And some of them actually undermine their credibility by what they do after it, and they shouldn't do it, because I think they've done a great job, and they should go.
Don Brash.
Well, Don Brash wasn't a politician. he didn't really understand politics. He's he's an interesting person with some views that I don't share. And interestingly, having been the leader of the party I now represent, I don't share many of Don Brash's views, actually. But he is a very clever man, so you've got to give him credit for that. But, yeah, I don't think... He was a bit of a one-off. Interestingly, David Shearer was a bit of a one-off too. A very talented, a very capable man, a very nice man, actually. But just didn't really get the politics. And so it's a dangerous business, politics, especially at national level. You've got to...
Now there's the talk about sort of career politicians, and some people say you need younger people. We, as you mentioned, we've got an 18-year-old candidate in the by-election that we just had. Do you think people need enough life experience first before going into politics, or the youth should be represented somehow?
So that's a very interesting point, because I'm the spokesperson for seniors for the National Party, and there are just about 1 million voters over 65 in New Zealand, and there's one MP representing those 1 million voters, if you put it from an age perspective, and that's me. Yeah. I'm the only MP, I think. Trevor Mallard might be very close, but you can't call him representative. He doesn't represent anyone any longer. So I'm probably the only MP over 65 in Parliament. And so to argue then that the under-30s should have representation, which they have got at least two or three or four, and there'll be a much lesser population than the over 65s are. So I think it's a spurious argument myself, and I also think that you certainly need to have life experience before you go to Parliament. I think it's much better for you if you do, and I think you make a much better contribution.
So career politicians, it's not such a good idea.
I don't think it is, and Britain's dominated by career politicians, interestingly, much more so than we are. Although some other parties in Parliament are much more dominated by career politicians than perhaps the National Party is. And so I think it's a bit of a danger. And we've seen some of our younger members of Parliament in recent times let themselves down, and the Parliament down, actually, by their antics. And I think it's very interesting that the 18-year-old in Palmerston North, who is also my youth MP, or was, has told me the other day he's going to go away now and think about life till he's 30 and then come back and have another go. Which I think is the best thing he could probably do, because he's an extraordinarily capable young man. But go to Parliament when you're 18.
Maybe just one MP over 65. But do you think with the size of the over 65 voting lobby, do you think that's overly influential?
I do, and I think it's dangerous. And I think it's most dangerous in council elections. And the reason I say that is that I watch this in councils myself. They have they've got a huge advantage or interest in stopping the world, and I think that's a real challenge for councils. That I think our older community can put a lot of pressure on councils to stop the world, and we've seen that very clearly with some of our development plans. So the fact you don't get new builds going on in places like Central Auckland and the leafy green suburbs in Auckland, it's because people resist it, and it's all of my generation of people resist that stuff. And I think that's where we can be really dangerous. And I saw it in Fielding itself, and you've got to say Fielding's a very smart town, but it resisted growth for a long time, and the older population certainly resist to some extent growth and have an over potential on that area because they vote.
Yeah. We sort of moved away from the cross-generational sort of contract with growing student loans and people saving for their own retirement. But is there some sort of conflict, you think, older people concerned about their grandchildren or older people concerned about preserving their superannuation? So do you see any signs of old people lobbying for the young?
I think that old people have got a lot more concern for the young than we give them credit for, and I think right now the concern that I get amongst almost all of my generation of people is that how we're ever going to repay the debt we've got in New Zealand at the moment. And if you look at my children, who are in their 40s, none of them have ever seen interest rates above about 7 or 8%. Well, I've seen interest rates of 26%. Now imagine what will happen to the Auckland property market if interest rates are 20%, or even the Palmerston North one, if interest rates are 26%, it won't happen. And so there's a lot of things that our younger generation have never had to think about or worry about. And so I think that there's a lot of concern amongst our older population about how their grandchildren or their children will ever manage to get the country back to a position that they were able to enjoy when they were
that age. Those lessons aren't getting across, are they? You don't get that sort of communication.
No, and I think it's because if you looked at the Stephen Joyces of the world, the first thing Stephen Joyce would be taught, and he does comment, like he's one of those politicians who comment, he talks about a lot, is the fact that we've got to repay this debt one day. You never hear this government talk about how we're going to do that or even considering it. So Grant Robinson can get up there today and spend $600 million this week, which he will, propping Auckland up, basically, or propping the country up, but propping Auckland up. No thought as to how we're going to repay that $600 million, which we're borrowing the whole lot of. Well, we're printing it, actually. We're borrowing it of ourselves. And so,
if we're borrowing it off ourselves, then when we repay it, repaying ourselves, so it's not necessarily a problem, is it?
Well, that's a very interesting point. That's a very interesting point, because I don't think it's understood very well at all. In fact, it's not understood. So effectively printing money, you're only reinventing yourself because we're effectively borrowing it off. But the interesting thing is that the international bond share of our borrowings has dropped dramatically. Now, the whole world's got the same problem. The whole Western world's got the same problem. And you talked very early on today about the fact that we might have to come to some consensus views on these things. And who's to say that we may never repay this debt, you know? And the world might not. Because given the fact that our borrowing's internal, not external, it changes the parameters significantly. And so there could be some innovative ways. And Bruce Beetham, who was a former representative of the Rangatee, would love this. Mm. Social credit, he stood for it.
There's issues of... my background was economic. But what you're doing is, given liquidity issues and demand issues and so on, you're actually allowing things to continue that otherwise would have shut down when you have all sorts of unemployed resources. So it's keeping those going. And there may be the question... is that going to be channeled into the right areas? Like there was talk a few years ago of after the global financial crisis of stimulate all the infrastructure things that we need. We don't hear that now with COVID and so on, but except that to some extent, if we're trying to keep things going and put all this spending in, then will some of that do that? Is that something happening in Parliament now?
It is actually, but it's interesting because if you thought about 2008, the roads of national significance came out of John Keats' cycleway, which was a very simple idea. It's made probably billions for people in New Zealand.
Yes.
So simple ideas can create a whole lot of stuff as well as infrastructure spend. But the roads of national significance, of which Transmission Gully is one of them, taken a long time to finish, but when it's finished it'll be amazing. So those things take time, unfortunately, and that's the challenge this government's got, is that they stopped the whole contracts when they first started and then had to kickstart them again, so that's taken the expertise out of the country, that's left the country, and a lot of the skilled labour's left the country, and so it's a very big challenge to get it going again, and our Gorge Road will be one of those challenges.
But when you say also repaying the debt, if it's used for things like that, future generations are going to get a massive benefit from those things as well.
Absolutely.
So it's, you're doing something for the future, then maybe it should be paid for the future.
I think so, and I think one of the unfortunate things is that the Reserve Bank's gone about this in an environment, and I don't criticise the Reserve Bank for doing what they've done, I think they've done as well as they could have, but they've done it in an environment where people's logical thought is of 2.5% interest, so I can buy a house. So I did.
Yeah.
Not thinking it might get to 20% one day or to 12%.
Yeah.
So all of our investment's gone into historic stuff rather than into what you might term futuristic stuff. And so I think the exciting thing for New Zealand is that we've now got KiwiSaver funds, which have got some rules around them which need to be changed, which will enable them to invest more heavily in New Zealand infrastructure. And we've got things like the super fund and ACC with massive investment funds which have got massive like New Zealand standard, which have got the potential to invest in some of this infrastructure stuff as well as partners, and so I think there's some encouraging stuff going on, but it's just so slow to get going.
Of course, this is a whole global thing, so maybe for the portfolio diversification for the large New Zealand funds to be invested overseas, and like you've got things like Canadian and Japanese pension funds investing in New Zealand.
Yeah, mostly buying our trees, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Nice if they'd buy a bit more broadly than just our freaking trees.
Yeah.
So interestingly, 80% of our forests are owned by foreign pension funds or foreign investors.
That's the cutting rights, is it? Or the
trees themselves. Not the land, trees. Not necessarily the land, no, but the trees are owned by them. And so consequently, any benefits from those trees end up in a pension fund in Canada, not in
Australia. Well, you've already got the money from their payment for the rights, presumably. Or yes. Are they underpriced? If not, then
it's very hard to decide whether they're underpriced or not, because you can't tell what impact the carbon stuff will have on that. And that's a big challenge for New Zealand, because I think that we're tending to plant trees in places we probably shouldn't. Yeah. And so that's a challenge that markets create, and they go away again, and then we cut them all down again.
But the wrong sort of trees as well.
Well, to some extent, that's right. Yes, it's an interesting thing, the tree thing, though, because it does have a propensity to change rural New Zealand in a manner that isn't necessarily positive, because people don't live and work in trees, whatever the forest owners think they do.
Yeah,
they live and work in
the town. Oh, smaller communities.
Yeah, so it's a transient.
So the carbon credits can go to Canada or to China. We don't keep the carbon credits.
No, that's a very complicated question.
Yeah.
It'll take a long time to answer that, but. No, that's not quite how it works. So
that's confusing.
It's a very complex issue. So New Zealand carbon credits are basically New Zealand carbon credits, and we manage them. One of the things that's under discussion at the moment is whether we're able to use international carbon credits to deal with this stuff. But back to your original question, so if a foreign investor buys forestry in New Zealand, they can then claim those carbon credits and take that, if they sell them, they can take that cash away with them. They can't use them to write off their own pollution in a foreign country, though.
Okay.
It's a very complex issue, and I think it's not clear to a lot of people what happens with them.
Thank you for listening to Manawatū Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatū People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatū Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.